Today is August 2nd, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Brent Burke over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. So, Brent, can you tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up?
I was born in Florida, but I grew up in Hawaii. I was born, I was actually adopted, and I was a very small child. I was a very small baby. I was taken from Florida to Hawaii, and I grew up in Hawaii, and I swam in Hawaii, and I went through all the age groups swimming here in Hawaii, and then in high school I swam, and in college I swam, but I'm a product of swimming in Hawaii.
And so what does that mean to you when you say you're a product of swimming in Hawaii? Can you elaborate on the meanings of that statement?
Well, it means that, I grew up swimming here, but my Olympic training was done in California. But it just means that I have my roots in Hawaii, and I'm happy about that. In 2003, I was inducted in the Hawaii Swimming Hall of Fame, and I'm kind of proud of that. And I noticed that there's some other people that are in the Hawaii Swimming Hall of Fame that didn't necessarily have their start in Hawaii swimming. You know, they're in there because they've lived here for a period of time, or they qualify on some other criteria. But I feel that I'm a homegrown product of Hawaii, which I feel good about.
Mm-hmm.
Then in high school, before my senior year in high school, the summer after between, I was able. That was my first summer. I was able to go and train at Santa Clara, which was under George Haynes, which was the best place to swim in the world at that time. So I was able to start my Olympic swimming training in '66. And I went the next summer before I went to college at Santa Clara in '67, and then '68 was the Olympic summer. So I actually had three full summers of training at Santa Clara, which was that was the place to be back then to train. Was there and with George Haynes.
Mm-hmm.
So I swam during that time with Mark Spitz and Don Scholander and all of the great swimmers that were coming out of Santa Clara at that time.
Mm-hmm. Brent, can I ask, how did you first get involved in swimming, and why did you first get involved in competitive swimming?
Just kind of a hyperactive kid, and started swimming when I was 8 years old. There weren't big soccer programs like there are now. I think my parents were looking for something to channel a lot of this hyperactivity that I had. So they did have age group swimming, and I started swimming. My mother did not want me to play football, so I didn't play that. I also was not a very good runner. I kind of have short legs, so sports involving running, track, baseball, football, soccer, those sort of things were kind of things I wasn't very good at. But I was pretty comfortable in the water. They started me at swimming lessons at a club we belonged to when I was 5 or 6. And it was mainly to get me going on some kind of activity to channel my high levels of energy that I had when I was small.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any swimming heroes or athlete idols that you looked up to when you were younger?
No, not really. And of course, out here in Hawaii, besides swimming, I was doing a lot of surfing too.
Mm.
A lot of board surfing, a lot of body surfing. So I was in the water like all the time that I wasn't in school or studying. I was in the water all the time. So besides swimming, I was also doing a lot of surfing and stuff out here.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, after I quit swimming, I did competitive body surfing all the way into my early 40s.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting
sport.
Yeah,
I have trophies here at home for winning at some meets here around Honolulu back then. Yeah, but I did competitive body surfing. So kept that up for another 20 years after I quit swimming. So, but no, as far as anybody looked up to, I mean, there was Duke Hanamoku, but I didn't really know much about him until I was older. There were some local guys that were good surfers, that I knew about, but, you know, and there were some other guys who were doing some surfing, but swimmers, no, not really in the swimming that I really knew about.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you summarize the proudest moments of your swimming career before 68?
Yeah, I set some records in high school that I was in high school, that was in 1967. I was the first swimmer to in the 100-yard freestyle to go under 49 seconds down here. And I went a time that I set a record and went a time that actually a record that stood for 10 years.
Hmm.
And it wasn't broken until 1976. So I was doing some good, and that was after that first summer in Santa Clara. And then I came back. I finished here in my senior in Punahou at a local high school. But I set some times that that stood up, the records that stood for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite an achievement. I was pretty happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
That was I felt pretty good about that.
Can you tell me about the Olympic trials, about the trials for 68, where they were held, and any challenges or, you know?
Yeah, that actually was that was probably the highlight of my career, because the trials were held in Long Beach, California, in the new pool down there in Long Beach. And I actually doubled at the trials. I got fourth in the 200 free, and I got second in the 200 free. And so the first day when I swam the 200, I got fourth, which put me as a qualifier to be on the relay team. So I actually made the team the first day by doing that. And then the second day when I swam the 400, I came in second in that. And that put me at that time number two in the world in the 400 freestyle.
Mm.
So, but I actually doubled at the meet, and that was the best meet I ever had in my whole career.
Mm. That's amazing.
Yeah, I did very well at the Olympic trials.
So, how did your friends and family, and you know, people that knew you in your hometown community, how did they react when they found out that you were going to compete in the Olympic Games?
Well, you know, I didn't know much about what was going on down here. I mean, I called my parents. My mother was sick, actually. My mother had cancer at that time. In fact, she died the following year.
Oh, sorry.
And but I, you know, called them the first day after I made it in the relay, and they were just shocked. You know, both my dad and mom were just shocked. And I said, yeah, I still got the 400 tomorrow. But after, you know, my mom, there was a lot of buzz down here in Honolulu. There was a lot of big articles in the paper about my swimming. And my dad was interviewed by the local paper people, and they quoted him in the newspaper, and they had all sorts of stuff going on down here locally about how I was doing, which I really wasn't aware of, because I had been away all summer swimming. Then we went down to the trials, and as soon as the team was put together, they took us to Colorado Springs for high altitude training for a whole month before going to Mexico City. But looking at the papers, the articles that my mother saved, there was quite a buzz going on down here about it. And then through the Olympics, it was quite a buzz. They had big full page write ups about how I was doing and the times I was going, even though I was only swimming one event. But all of that I was not aware of. I was swimming and keeping my nose to the grindstone, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I was far away. You know, I was in Colorado, then I was in Mexico City. And then at the Olympics, my mom and dad did come. My mother was ailing. She wasn't doing very well, but she did come. They did see me swim. And so that was pretty exciting. I was glad that they could come. But I know that my dad said when he heard that he made the team, he told everybody that that was the greatest thing that ever happened to him.
Oh, wow.
He was just, yeah, he was just real excited about it. And he just kept saying that's the greatest thing. And he was a pretty well-known doctor in town down here. He had a lot of patients. He was a very well-known physician in town. But he felt that you know, he invested a lot of time and money for me to stay up there and swim, you know, housing and feeding me and all that stuff during the summer for 3 summers. I mean, we were renting. I was living with another guy from Hawaii, Alan Richardson, who did not make the team. But it was expensive for him. I mean, to put me up in an apartment and, you know, all that stuff. So, you know, I don't know if the right words are paid off, but he was just over, you know, just so he couldn't believe that I made the team.
Yeah. So you mentioned high altitude training in Colorado Springs. Can you tell me a little bit more about your experience with high altitude training and preparing for the altitude?
Well, it was kind of hard. You know, we did a lot of swimming, and they put us up at the Broadmoor Hotel, and you know, I was 19 at the time, so I was kind of one of the younger guys on the team. A lot of the older guys were kind of taken in stride. They'd go out and they'd play golf and they'd fool around with stuff at the hotel. They'd do archery and they'd go out and do shooting. And, you know, I just kind of went and swam, went home, rested, went back and swam, went to sleep, you know. And so it was just kind of a grind for me. We were able to, we did get away. We went actually, there were a number of us that went up, a few of us that went up to, there was a group called Cream. I don't know if you remember Cream, but they had a concert in Denver.
Yeah.
And we did get away, and we went up to that concert just to kind of get away from the training camp kind of deal for one night. And that was kind of fun. We came back. We kind of got in trouble, though, because we didn't really tell the coaches where we went. We got in the older guys that were with our group, about five or six of us that went, they got kind of chewed out by the coaches. Nobody was suspended or anything, but it was kind of a no-no. But it was kind of a grind. We worked out at the Air Force Academy, which was kind of a sterile atmosphere. It was an indoor pool. I didn't really like indoor pools that much. They smell funny. The air is kind of a lot of humidity. The air is kind of stuffy. I don't really like indoor pools. So it was kind of a grind. And like I mentioned, when I first talked on Wednesday, I just didn't swim very well at altitude. My event, the 400 meters free, that's 8 lengths of a 50-meter pool. It's kind of a long event.
Mm-hmm.
And it was long events, you know, you got less, more and more short of breath and buildup in your muscle, lactose buildup and this sort of thing. So it was hard. It was hard to work out. It was hard to do the events. It was hard to swim, period, mm-hmm. You know. So...
Was there anyone on the team with whom you were particularly close? Anybody that you remember?
Well, I was going to say that Santa Clara, that particular year, 68, I don't think it's ever been repeated, but from Santa Clara, we put 8 girls and 8 boys on the Olympic team.
Mm-hmm.
So there were 16 people from Santa Clara Swim Club, one club, that we had 16 people on the Olympic swimming team. And so I had, 16 teammates who I had known for a number of years were on the team. So outside of that group, I really didn't know very many. I didn't know very many of the people, other people on the team. So, I had some friends, but we were all pretty much teammates from Santa Clara.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had known them from before. And they were, one friend, Brian Jobe, I went to Stanford, he went to Stanford also, so I knew Brian from Stanford, Greg Buckingham went to Stanford, and I knew him, so there were a few that were also, I knew from college swimming, there were a few, outside of that, I really didn't know very many of the other people,
Well, Do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. Olympic team while you were...
No. Didn't hear anything about that. The thing that those two black guys did with raising their arms, I don't think I was even aware of that when I was down in Mexico City.
I see.
I wasn't very political at the time. I don't think I even hear... I didn't even hear about that, I think, until long after the games were over. But the only thing I did in Mexico City, I went to a couple of events. I did see they gave us some tickets. They gave us some complimentary tickets. I did go see, I remember seeing the finals of the 100-meter dash, the run. And I had a ticket right by the finish line. That was pretty exciting. You know, that's one of the glamour events of the games, the 100-meter dash for men.
Mm-hmm.
And watching those guys rip down that 100 yards. I went to a water polo game, and I saw Gary Shear, who is a top water polo player, saw him get his arm broken by a guy from Hungary. Saw that game in person. He got out of the pool, and his arm was sticking out of his shoulder.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, against Hungary. They actually pulled, literally, the Hungary water polo player literally pulled his arm out of its socket, and he was out of the game. So I saw that happen, but I saw that game. And another story I like to tell about was the opening ceremonies. One of the things there was about the Russians, and I didn't have much contact with the Russians, but I do remember getting ready to get on the bus to go down to the opening ceremonies, and all the Russians were nearby, and everybody was kind of looking at the Russian team, and they were, you know, pretty awe-inspiring. But the story I like to tell about the opening ceremonies is we were standing there in the near the stadium waiting to go in. We were marching in with our team, and some of the older guys were carrying raincoats, and it was a clear, perfect night, and I was saying, why are you guys carrying raincoats? And they said, you'll see. So we went inside, we walked in, walked around, went to the middle. All the teams formed up in the middle of the field there. They went through the ceremonies, and then what do they do at the Olympic ceremonies? Do you remember? I don't think they do it now, but do you remember what they used to do?
They release the doves, the peace.
Yeah,
doves.
What do birds do when they fly around after being cooped up?
They have to go to the restroom.
They fire away there. So all these guys dove under their raincoats, and the rest of us dodos are sitting there getting the dodo from the birds, and it was pretty funny, but the raincoat guys were all set. They were all prepared, so it was pretty funny. It never occurred to you, right? I mean, but yeah, those birds, they buzz around. I mean, there's, I don't know, hundreds of them.
Ugh.
So that was pretty funny,
yeah.
If I remember that.
That
antidote from the games.
Yeah, that's.
But no, the political thing I didn't follow at all. You know, like I said, I was 19. I was pretty focused on swimming. Same thing during the summers. I mean, we take a break every now and then from training. We might go to the beach. I took a, you know, we might go to Lake Tahoe. But generally, we were grinding.
Mm-hmm.
And. Yeah, it was pretty serious, intense. You know, get up 8:30, go for 2 hours, go home, sleep, rest, come back in the afternoon for 2 hours, eat dinner, go to sleep, get up the next day, same thing. You know, day after day after day. So it was pretty intense training, and then down to the games. There just wasn't that much to do. I mean, we lived in the village, and so. But going back to my experiences, it was, besides the altitude, it was also very difficult in that particular games, because the games in Mexico City, they happened in October, and they were long. It was there, we were there for 3 weeks, so it was late in the year. It was a long period of time that we were there, and so in fact, I didn't swim until the third week, so I had a couple of weeks down there where I just didn't do anything. I just kind of sat around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very difficult to not get exposed to water, which could give you the upset stomach and stuff. People, you know, you brush your teeth with bottled water. But I finally, the third week, I did get some stomach flu around the time that I was swimming my race.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and as did everybody else. Most people, everybody got sick down there, just about. And then the day of the finals, I went with Buckingham to get a haircut, just to get, you know, just to get a little bit of a haircut before that morning. So I was getting up, got out of the barber's chair, and all of a sudden I started spinning. So I told Buckingham, I said, I don't feel too good. I got to go back and lie down. So I started walking back. This was the morning of the finals. I assumed the finals that night. And I couldn't walk. I was spinning, lightheaded. And I had to lie down right by the side, by the walking path on the grass. And it stopped, and I got up. And at the bottom of each building in the there was a little infirmary. So I started spinning again as I got very near. So I went to the infirmary, and she looked at me, and she said, boy, you don't look too good. And I said, yeah, you better check me out. I got the finals of 400-meter freestyle tonight. So they checked me out. I sat there for a few hours, and they did my blood pressure and everything, but I was there wasn't really. And eventually, I was able to walk, and the spinning, the lightheadedness stopped. So that's what was going on with me the day of the finals. So I went down. I just didn't swim very well that night at all. I had a very tough finals.
Yeah. Well, what were your impressions of the Olympic Village? What did you think of your accommodations there?
It was nice. I don't remember it that well, but it was adequate. I mean, it was like a maybe not quite as nice as a college dorm, but they had cafeterias, they had facilities. You know, like I said, you get a haircut. They had medical facility. They had infirmaries there. They had medical people to help you out. They were high rises. They were, if I remember, they were about 9 or maybe 10 stories high. And I think there were like maybe 4 people to a room. You know, it wasn't real private. But it seemed to be nice. Seemed to be adequate.
Mm-hmm.
They had cafeterias where you could, you know, go in and get pretty much anything you wanted to eat. But you did have to watch out for the water. You know, the water down there in Mexico, you don't want to drink it, especially back then. It was worse back then than it is now. You brush your teeth with bottled water if you could. But, you know, still we had to swim. You know, we swam in water that was local water, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was still, and I did finally, you know, these days they have the Olympics now within a, you know, week and a half. I mean, boom, boom, you're done within 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
You're with your swimming. But down there, I mean, we swam for, it was like weeks. I think it was really dragged out over an extended period of time. And being in October, that's very late in the year because, you know, you started your training back in May, and then you went all through the summer and swam. Then you had a whole other month in Colorado Springs, and then you finally got down there and swam the Olympics. So it's very long, drawn-out deal. That's like almost 6 months. And it's very, very hard to stay at the top of your game for that long a time, you know. Some people, you know, the great swimmers can do it, but the guys that are, you know, like me, that are just kind of pedaling along, it's very hard to maintain that high level for that long a period of time. Yeah, it's just tough. It's very difficult to do that.
Yeah, I can't imagine trying to do that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was very happy to be there. I was very happy, glad I made the team. I was really proud of myself of doubling at the trials. But then you got down there, like I said, you went through the month of training, and then you still had another, you know, 2-3 months to go before this whole thing was over. So, mm-hmm. But that's kind of how it was.
Yeah, what an endurance event. So Brent, what were your impressions of Mexico City and its people?
I really did not get outside the loop of, I didn't go into town. There were lots of Mexicans around the village, you know. You would go out in your bus, they'd be in droves right outside the village trying to, you know, catch an eye of the athletes, you know, trying to check them out and watch them and stuff like that. But I did not go into town, couldn't tell you anything about Mexico City itself. I took a bus. I'd go to the events. I'd come back to the village. When the games were over, my mom and dad said, "Hey, look, do you want to go somewhere? You want to go to Acapulco for a few days, you know?" And I was just so burned out. I said, "Nope, just get me out of here. I want to get out of here, go back home." And in fact, I went to Honolulu, came back to Hawaii. I skipped that quarter of school at Stanford, and I came back and spent time at home through November and December. I went back to school finally in January for the winter quarter. Mm. I did not have any real contact with any Mexican people or go into town at all. So I just can't tell you.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I've never been back there. That was the only time that I've ever been. I've been to Mexico, Ensenada, and along there a couple times, but really have not spent much time in Mexico at all.
Yeah. Well, did you have any memorable interactions with members of athletes from the Soviet bloc, like members of
No, it was just that time we saw them. You know, I didn't know, not really. We saw them as a group. You know, they were wearing, I think they were wearing their red things with the sickles on them or whatever it was. So, no, I did not.
Mm. What about East German team? Any memories of the
no.
East German team?
No. You got to remember, I was a 19-year-old kid. You know, just a young kid. And just really focused on swimming and just really didn't do much other than that.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a boring deal.
Do you remember the drug testing program, which was first implemented?
You know, that's interesting. I read that, and to tell you the truth, I don't. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know there was any kind of drug testing. I never got tested, to my knowledge. I don't remember being tested. So I was actually, I thought drug testing was later than that. Was 68 the first time they had drug testing?
It wasn't the first time, but it was the first summer games in which kind of a standardized implementation was carried out.
No, I don't remember the swimmers really being involved in it. They may have been doing it to the track people, the wrestlers, you know, maybe the weightlifters, but I don't remember even anybody saying, "Oh, did you know, I got tested, did you?" I don't remember any of that happening to the swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
Nor do I know of anybody using any kind of drugs, you know, of the swimmers. At least at Santa Clara, that was, you know, I mean, some people smoke marijuana and stuff like that, but they were not using performance dancing or doping of blood or anything like that I know of.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I didn't even do I didn't even lift weights. You know, all I did was swim. Lifting weights, although some of the guys did do weightlifting, lifting the weights made, I know it's a little off the track here, but it just stiffened me up, and I just, all I did was swim.
Mm-hmm.
Put on my Speedo and swim, and that was it. I didn't even use goggles. So it was just hardcore swimming. Just put the Speedo on and get in the pool and go. But no, I actually when I saw that on your list, I was surprised about the drug testing. And my guess is that swimmers probably were not focused upon. They were probably more, you know, like I said, wrestlers, maybe the wrestlers, bodybuilders, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Maybe the track guys a little bit, but. I did not have any kind of knowledge or anything of drug testing.
I see. Brent, were you there for the closing ceremony, and did you watch it?
No, I left.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't leave. I just didn't go to the closing ceremonies.
Okay.
Yeah, I just chose not to go.
So can you kind of tell me what happened with your swimming career after 1968?
Well, I had just completed my freshman year, and so I had 3 more years of swimming in college to do. And the thing was that, like I said, with my short legs, I was a better swimmer long course than I was short course. because I didn't have as many turns, you know, because the pool is bigger and longer. You had fewer turns. But I did go back my sophomore year when I first went back to Stanford after the Olympics. I did swim. I swam very well sophomore year at the NC2As. That's the national college swim meet.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a fifth, a sixth, and I think a tenth. And then our relay team also came in the top three. So I actually had All-American in four events my sophomore year at Stanford in swimming.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the 200 free, the 500 free, and the 1650 free, and the 800 freestyle relay, the 4x200 relay. So I got four All-American recognitions. Junior year, they had the NC2As was at altitude to get to Salt Lake City, and I swam very terribly there. Did not have a good meet because of the altitude. And then senior year, I swam okay, but senior year swimming had become more. I was on scholarship at Stanford. Swimming had become more of a job by that point. And also senior year, I played water polo, and I got a letter in water polo. So my senior year, I did pretty much all I could do because I knew it was the end of my swimming career. So, yeah, I did swim very well the next 3 years at Stanford. We had dual meets, which I swam. It turned out at Stanford that I ended up swimming middle and long distance instead of sprinting because the I wasn't quite as fast as the other sprinters. They were bigger guys than me. So I would, at the dual meets, I would swim the 1,000 yard freestyle and the 500 yard freestyle, those two long events. And I became a pretty good middle to long distance swimmer. I did pretty well, you know, against UCLA and SC and some of the teams we had to swim against.
Mm-hmm.
But my main event was the 500 free and the 500 yards, the 400 meter freestyle, uh-huh. middle to long, middle distance. But yeah, so I had three more years, kept on swimming. And then when I, after that, there really was no way to continue swimming. I was outside of college because there was really no funding as there is now, you know, where you get sponsors and stuff like that to keep paying your living expenses. So pretty much when you were done with college, you were done swimming. That was the end of it. Mark Spitz did go on. He kept swimming, but he had ways of making money because of his notoriety. But I think Spitz quit swimming, I think, when he was 23.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't after 72, I don't think he kept swimming after that. But there was no way, as there is now, to make money. I mean, the kind of money that Phelps and these guys make is, you know, incredible. I mean, we just didn't have those opportunities back then at all.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, what you think about that, what you think about amateurism, what it was in 68, what it meant to be an amateur in 68 compared to what it's become now. What are your thoughts about
that? It's just night and day. It's night and day because, I mean, even if you're one of the top five or six or seven swimmers, I think you can get probably sponsors and pick up some stream of income somewhere from somebody. But back then we were truly amateurs. No doubt about it. As were most of the other sports. I mean, maybe in track they got a little bit of money, but everybody really was a true amateur. And nowadays, I mean, of course, I mean, there's just so much money anyway. I mean, it's night and day. I mean, for some of these guys to be able to swim into their 30s is really, really something.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the swimmers are in their 30s. Some of the sprinters, I think Lisick or whatever, he's a guy that's done well in the 50 free, is 32, I think, something like that. You won't see, you know, longer distance guys keep swimming. It's just too hard in the body.
Yeah.
But yeah, with you know, like I said, my dad paid for my room and board, and I think I did a little bit of work here and there when I had some free time. One summer I lifeguarded down in Southern California and then swam as a lifeguard down there in a lifeguard meet. But I made like $500 for about a month work, which was back then was a fair amount of money, a little bit of money for a kid. But there really was no way to, you know, it's just so different now. So, and in fact, you know, there was a Sports Illustrated magazines in 08 about Phelps and how Phelps was going to break all of Spitz's records and this and that. And the woman that wrote the article just completely left out the whole economic side of it. One of the biggest things about between Spitz and Phelps and why Phelps can go on Olympic after Olympic after Olympics is he's got $1 million a year of income. So he can support himself and pay for his training and living and travel. Travel expenses are extremely expensive. And, in fact, what I did in 08 is I wrote a letter to Sports Illustrated, kind of contesting that, you know, first of all, it wasn't over. Phelps had not, you know, she was saying it's over. And I said, it ain't over till it's over, until he does this, until he breaks Mark's records. You know, I was kind of taken aback by all that. But I also said that she had completely left out the whole economic discussion between the periods and between the careers of the two swimmers. Just was completely different economic time back then. And they printed the letter. The letter actually ended up in Sports Illustrated.
Oh, wow. That's neat.
Yeah, my letter was printed, and my name was in there, and it was in letters to the editors. And, they understood the point I was making. And as it turned out, Phelps, in 08, when he won all the medals, he actually didn't need one stroke of good luck. He needed two. You know, that was the year that he barely touched out the guy in the butterfly, and he barely got that gold medal in the butterfly. I don't know if you remember or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then the relay team, the final guy on the relay team had to come from far behind. And I remember, but he barely touched out the guy from France. So Phelps had not only one stroke of good luck, but he had two, which then allowed him to, without one of those, he would not have beaten Mark Spitz and gotten more medals than him and won games.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very, very lucky to get it. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but there was big difference between then and now economically. And so I mean, like Mark, I knew Mark. I swam with him for 3 years, and I mean, he lived at home. His dad paid for everything. He lived at home. They lived in Santa Clara. Mom drove him to practice every day, drove him home, went home, rested, came back, worked out, and he didn't have any kind of, you know, he wouldn't get any money from anywhere.
Yeah.
Know. Yeah, it just wasn't.
It's a big difference.
Way different.
So Brent, are you currently participating in a sport or involved in any sports in any way?
No, not really. I mean, I do swim a little bit. I am involved in the Hawaii Olympic. I am president of the Hawaii Olympians right now. We have an Olympic group down here, we get together every year. So I am president of the Hawaii Olympians right now. But I'm 64, so I'm kind of out of shape. I put on a bunch of weight, got a bit heavy, a lot heavier than I was when I swam. So just, you know, nothing real active right now.
Uh-huh. Well, what for you was the most meaningful part of participating in the Olympic movement and being involved in the Olympic Games?
Well, for me, as far as it gave me a sense of confidence. Okay, that because my mother always told me, she said, you know, you set your mind to something, if you really set your mind to it, you can do it. You know, and to set a goal like that for a 3-year period, and then to make the team, and to get on the team, gave me through the whole rest of my life a real feeling of self-confidence, you know, in myself and my abilities. I know that's not quite your answer, but I have a very high regard for the Olympics. I have a very high regard for the other Olympians that I met down here from Hawaii. There's guys like Bill Smith, and he swam the same events that I swam, and he got gold medals in 1948 in the events that I swam. And I got to know him down here. He passed away earlier this year. He was 88 years old, and he passed on. But just, you know, and what Duke Onomoku did, who was a swimmer from Hawaii down here, and I, you know, Mark Spitz, I have great respect for Mark for what he accomplished. And so, over the years, you know, Phelps and Amy Van Dyken from 96, when Amy came out of nowhere, this woman, won, I mean, she's a hero of mine, and she won these gold medals kind of out of nowhere, you know. So, but not only swimmers, but I'm a big sports. I love football. I like basketball, like volleyball. I'm a very interested in all kinds of sports. But realizing that the Olympics is really the epitome of what you could achieve, particularly in amateur sports back, you know, then and now. Although now it's not really an amateur, they're not really amateurs anymore. But still, these guys, Phelps, Lochte, these guys, people don't understand how fast these guys are swimming now. And they are swimming incredibly fast. It's just unbelievable how fast these guys are swimming. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know why. I mean, they swim, they do weights, but I don't know why they're going so much faster. But it's really astounding, you know, what they're doing these times, the last 5 to 10 years.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, do you have any knowledge of swimming at all?
Just bare minimum, really.
Yeah.
Just enough to
Well,
do.
It goes back, you know, to actually 2000, this guy named Thorpe from Australia. In my event, he in the 400 meter freestyle, he did times that nobody could believe. But do you know how big his feet are?
No, how big are his feet?
He wears size 18 shoes.
Oh my gosh, are his feet shaped like flippers?
The guy literally has flippers for feet. I mean, mine are 10 and a half. Okay, got an average size foot. His are size 18.
Wow.
His are like 5 or 6 inches bigger than my feet. Okay. And that's like putting on a pair of flippers or fins, okay?
Yeah.
And going down to swim. I mean, if I wore flippers when I swim, I could have beaten anybody in the world, okay, with my flippers on. Okay? And he's got size 18 feet, this guy.
That's
so
crazy.
It's funny.
So anyway. Brent, what in your opinion is the legacy of the 1968 U.S. Olympic team? If you were to try to describe the historical impact, the legacy of the 68 U.S. team, what do you think that would be?
No, that's a hard question. I'm not really sure. I think that the Olympics in the 60s, 64 and 68, I think that they were really the beginning of the period of the true modern Olympics, okay? And what I mean by that is that the people that participated, for instance, the timing mechanisms that they used were like we had in the swimming pool, we had at the end of the wall, you touched the wall and stopped your time, you know? And the timing mechanisms were very modern. What they used then, they use now. Back in the 50s and before that, they were using handheld timers. You know, you do with a stopwatch in your hand. At the trials in Long Beach, you know, I got fourth in the 200 free by 1/1000th of a second. And in the Florida Free, I got second over the third place guy by 2/100ths of a second. Okay.
Mm.
And that's 40 some odd years ago. And I'm making the team by a thousandth of a second, you know? And so I think that the 64-68 period was the beginning of the true modern period of Olympics, of more sophisticated training methods, better training methods, dietary considerations, the facilities, the times, the way they timed you, what's the word I'm trying to think of?
Technology?
Part of the facilities, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of the part of the legacy, I think, of those games, those games. So, because 40 years before that, 1928, I mean, it was primitive, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're out swimming in canals almost, or swimming in, putting up buoy heads in the middle of a harbor somewhere. But from 68 to 08 to 40 years, you know, from to now, things really haven't changed very much, I don't think, except that people are going a lot faster.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the legacy of the 64 and 68 Olympics was the beginning of the modern period.
Yeah.
In regards to that, the political stuff, that's all, you know, the guys doing the salute and everything. Nah, I don't care about all that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know about that as being that relevant, to be honest with you. I mean, to me, that was in a way disrespectful, you know. I guess I don't agree with all that stuff, you know. I don't think that was the right forum to do that sort of thing. I think those guys, if they're you know, they should... You know, they should be above all that, I think. These guys are Olympians, some of the best runners in the world, and I think, you know, I think they should be more concerned with being good role models than trying to be protesters or whatever the right word is. So as far as starting some kind of big political movements, I don't think they did any of that or accomplished anything, really, at least in my opinion.
Well, you said earlier that the 68 swim team was kind of unique because it's something that maybe hadn't been done before or since was all the swimmers coming from, or a majority of them coming from one club. Do you think
Yep.
that was part of what made the 68 team special?
Yeah, that, you know, I mean, 16 people, I mean, you got, you know, the Olympic swim team only had like about, 30, I don't know how many swimmers were on the team, but we had 16 come from Santa Clara. And, you know, I know they didn't put that many more. I don't think any team before or since had that many. I know Hawaii sent a lot of swimmers in the 40s and 50s from Hawaii Swim Club down here, but they didn't send those 16.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. And that's really, I think, something special to have all those, to have eight guys and eight girls go from one team. So, and just about everybody swam pretty well too. The girls did great. I mean, they won all kinds of medals. The girls, they did really well. They were, you know, the power of the girls team. As far as the men go, we had Scholender, we had Spitz, we had Buckingham. But they were the only guys, I think, that got medals. I didn't get a medal, and I don't think that the other guys from Santa Clara got medals.
Hmm.
But they were there. You know, they were part of the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Brent, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Try again the question.
What one piece of advice would you give to somebody, to say a young athlete today who was trying to get into the Olympics?
Well, it's a lot harder these days than it was back then, at least in swimming. In swimming, they took three of the finalists. Now they take only two. So I think my advice would be to just do the best that you can, realizing that it is very difficult to make the team, and that you're probably your chances of making a team are going to be kind of slim. But to work as hard as you can, to stay focused, don't, you know, try not to get off the track, but realizing it's going to be hard, and that you're going to be, there's going to be kids that will dominate, like Phelps and Lochte and these guys. They'll take up, they'll win more than one or two events. They'll win three or four or five events. And when they get first place, that means even less openings for people in those events. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if Phelps only took up one spot with one event, then you'd have four or five other people that could make the team possibly. But when he gets first in four or five or six events, that knocks out four or five people.
Right.
From making the team. That means those events he wins, the best you can do to make the team is get second. So it really means there's only one spot, okay?
Yeah.
So, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and in my day, they took three, okay? And it's tough because in track, they take three. In track, the United States will have three people at an event. And I don't understand why track has three and swimming only has two. You know, they changed that about 10 years ago, and I don't know why track doesn't take two. I don't understand that. You know, it's kind of weird. So, you know, and there's team sports that we had a girl down here, a water polo player, who was cut the last, I think in 04. She was the last, you know, she was like the 13th person to make a 12-person team, you know. And, it, you know, she was just as good as anybody else, but the coaches just didn't want to take her. So my advice is to persevere, you know, keep working as hard as you can, but realize it's they're very long odds. The odds are long.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be realistic about it, I think.
Well, before we wrap up this conversation, is there anything else that you wanted to get on record?
On the record. No, I mean, you know, I was, like I said, I could, the key in getting to that level is to, besides the training, the dietary and all that stuff, you have to get the competition and you have to go and be competing with and against the best all the time. Okay. That's one thing I could not get in the way. I didn't have any competition out here. So being able to go to Santa Clara and every day you're in the pool with Spitz, Schollander, Gary Ullman, you know, all these great swimmers, it builds you because, in my opinion, at that level, the mental aspect of whatever sport you're doing is probably more important than the physical aspect of it. In other words, you have to convince yourself that you can win and do well. And if you don't have that self-confidence and the mental wherewithal, you're not going to be able to do it.
Mm.
Because everybody's in good shape. Everybody works hard. Everybody's got the great body. Everybody's real strong. Everybody's done all the yardage and all the swimming and all the running and all the whatever. But it's the guys that get to the top are the guys that have the mental wherewithal to do it. I mean, another story that I tell was my roommate Alan Richardson was talking. We were talking a few weeks before the Olympic trials, and he said, he asked, we're just sitting there, you know, after lunch or whatever, he said, well, how do you think you're going to do? And I said, well, you know, I've looked at my competition, I've looked at the heat sheets, and I think I'm going to get second or third in the 400, and I think I'm going to get third or fourth in the 200. And he looked at me and he said, how can you say that? And I said, well, that's just what I think I'm going to do. And I did it, you know?
Yeah.
That's exactly what I did.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, after a period of time of swimming against these guys, going to nationals, going to whatever, you know who you can beat and who you can't. You should be able to know who you can beat and who you can't beat. And you have to get to that level, both physically and mentally, in my opinion, to be able to do that, those kind of things, mm-hmm. and to make an Olympic team. And the other thing is, I think, too, that a lot of it, too, I think is timing. That in 1968, I was 19. For me, it was my time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And because the Olympics are only every 4 years, there will be periods where the Olympics will not hit someone at their right time. Okay?
Yeah.
That either you're too young or you're too old or you're too da-da-da-da-da-da. And in 1968, 19, it was my time.
Yeah. That's
you know,
a
it was
point.
A perfect time for me because I know there's other great swimmers that I swam against who didn't even come close to making the Olympic team, okay? Because it was before their time, or they quit swimming before the Olympics, or whatever it was. But the timing was just not the right time for them in their life or their age or their whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it, not a lot of it, but some of it is timing and luck. A little bit of that helps, okay? So I think it's, some of it is that. But most important, I think, is the mental aspect of your sport.
Absolutely.
And to work and prepare yourself mentally to achieve and to do what you want to do.
Brent, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time and your memories.